This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Damien Carrick with you. Welcome to The Law Report. In a 2-1 decision, the Victorian Court of Appeal has upheld the conviction of Cardinal George Pell on 5 child sex offences, 4 of which took place in the sacristy of St Patrick's Cathedral and the other one in an adjacent corridor.
By a majority of 2-1, the Court of Appeal has dismissed Cardinal George Pell's appeal against his conviction for the commission of sexual offences. He will continue to serve his sentence of 6 years imprisonment.
Chief Justice of Victoria, Anne Ferguson. Cardinal George Pell remains behind bars following last week's majority 2-1 decision of the Victorian Court of Appeal, which upheld his conviction on 5 child sex offences. Pell's legal team have confirmed that they will appeal the decision to the High Court of Australia. So, what exactly did the 3 judges of the Court of Appeal decide? What are the prospects of any High Court of Australia appeal? And where does this leave the law more generally when it comes to trials of historical child sex abuse cases, where it is ultimately the word of the complainant against the word of the accused? Here's the reaction of the complainant. He asked his lawyer, Viv Waller, to read a statement to the media.
I am relieved by the decision of the Court of Appeal. It is 4 years since I reported to the police. The criminal process has been stressful. The journey has taken me to places that, in my darkest moments, I feared I would not return from. The justice machine rolls on with all of its processes and punditry, almost forgetting about the people at the heart of the matter. Despite this, I appreciate that the criminal process has afforded Pell every opportunity to challenge the charges and every opportunity to be heard. I am glad he has had the best legal representation that money can buy. There are a lot of checks and balances in the criminal justice system, and the appeals process is one of them.
And that appeal process will definitely continue. Pell's legal team want to take this case to the High Court. David Maher is a journalist with The Guardian, and Melbourne University law professor Jeremy Gans is a criminal law expert. They both join me now. David Maher, what do you say this ruling tells us about the criminal justice system?
It tells us in Australia that the criminal justice system can stare down one of the most powerful organisations on earth and a famous and powerful accused and condemn him, send him to prison for a squalid crime of this kind. It shows us the power of the justice system in this country. That was a mighty thing, that the jury verdict was upheld by the Court of Appeal. We don't often in our lives see power brought to account in that way in this country. Maybe we'll see it more often in future.
Jeremy Gans, what's your view?
Well, I think it says all that, but it also says that judges don't always speak with the same voice. Sometimes they disagree, even on cases like this, perhaps especially on cases like this.
Let's talk about the grounds of appeal. There were 3 grounds of appeal that the court had to rule on. 2 were dismissed by all 3 judges. Jeremy Gans, briefly, can you describe those 2 grounds very quickly and why they were dismissed, so we can then concentrate on the ground of appeal, which was at the heart of this majority decision?
Well, the first ground was that when Cardinal Pell pled not guilty, the jury panel weren't in the room with him. They were watching on video in the next room. The Court of Appeal easily dismissed that. They said that still counts as presence, as required by the statute. The other ground was another video, one that Robert Richter, Pell's counsel, wanted to show the jury at the end of the trial, and he was stopped by the trial judge. The Court of Appeal watched the video and they said the trial judge shouldn't have shown it and was right not to show it because it was tangentious and wouldn't have helped the jury understand the case.
And this was a video which simply had sort of dots on a map and would show where people, according to the defence, would have been at the time of the offending. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so all 3 judges were unanimous in dismissing grounds 2 and 3, the video evidence and the not guilty plea being made not physically in front of the jury. Let's now concentrate on the heart of this decision. The first ground of appeal, whether or not it was reasonable for the jury to reach a guilty verdict on the evidence presented. On this ground, round, they were split. Two judges, the majority, said yes. One judge said no. What were the two essential arguments put forward by Pell's defence team to argue that it was unreasonable? David Marr.
Well, they put together a list of obstacles which they saw to the reasonableness of the jury's verdict. And these were largely set out in the evidence that was given by the witnesses who appeared for the defence of Pell. And it was everything from, you know, where Pell was standing, where he was moving, whether he'd be accompanied, whether doors were open, whether doors were shut, colours of bottles of wine, and all of that. And on the other hand, there was the evidence of the complainant. Now, they're the facts, but once the law was defined, what the judges were doing actually was operating as another jury and looking at the facts from the start all over again.
So what evidence or information did the Court of Appeal judges, the three of them, consider or look at when reaching their views about the 13 obstacles or the credibility of the complainant?
They looked at everything. Everything in the trial that saw Pell convicted had been video recorded. They looked at over 30 hours of video recording. They read thousands of pages of transcript. They went to the cathedral. And it's clear from a little note in the majority judgment, they tried on the robes and worked out, to their satisfaction, to the satisfaction of the majority, that the sexual offence could be committed while Pell was wearing those robes.
Because one of the 13 obstacles, I think it was the 13 obstacles, was the argument of the defence was that it was the robes were too heavy to be lifted and the sexual offences could not have taken place.
They put them on.
They put them on, yep.
And there are two or three points where the dissenting judge, Mark Weinberg, really, really disbelieved Pell's accuser. And one of them is around the robes, whether they can be, you know, lifted, taken aside. The robes were big, and it just pleases me enormously, the thought that the three judges swanned around at some point wearing the Archbishop's robes.
Okay, let's talk about the majority. The Chief Justice Anne Ferguson and the President of the Court of Appeal, Chris Maxwell, looked at this evidence, the video evidence of the complainant, and said, quote, "He was a very compelling witness, was clearly not a liar and was not a fantasist and was a witness of truth."
Throughout his evidence, the complainant came across as someone who was telling the truth. He did not seek to embellish his evidence or tailor it in a manner favourable to the prosecution. As might have been expected, there were some things that he could remember and many things which he could not. And his explanations of why that was so had the ring of truth.
Jeremy Gans, that's an emphatic endorsement, isn't it?
It's a huge endorsement. And they specifically said that they had watched the videos and were impressed. Then they read the transcripts and they were impressed. And then after they reviewed all of the evidence put forward for the defence, they were not left in doubt that the complainant was telling the truth.
What did they say about the 13 obstacles? Because, I mean, there are two issues, the credibility of the complainant, but also the idea that it was factually impossible for this sequence of events to have taken place. Because, for instance, Pell could never have been alone in the sacristy at the time. This physical impossibility about the robes being too heavy to expose the genitals. What did they say when they looked at the evidence over and above the credibility of the complainant?
Their point over and over again was that none of those things meant that the jury must have a doubt about Pell's guilt.
You have the majority, Maxwell and Chief Justice Ferguson, dismissing the appeal, but you have Justice Weinberg in the minority. He came to the opposite view.
I respectfully dissent. In my view, upon the whole of the evidence, it was not open to the jury to be satisfied beyond reasonable doubt of the guilt of the applicant.
Chief Justice Ferguson summarised Weinberg's position this way.
In his dissenting judgment, Judge Justice Weinberg found that at times the complainant was inclined to embellish aspects of his account. He concluded that his evidence contained discrepancies, displayed inadequacies, and otherwise lacked probative value so as to cause him to have a doubt as to the applicant's guilt. He could not exclude as a reasonable possibility that some of what the complainant said was concocted.
So, Jeremy Gans, how usual is it for Court of Appeal judges to take such diametrically opposed views to the credibility of a witness? They both saw the same video, two were emphatic in their support, and one was very dubious, very critical.
Courts do disagree at times, but they agree most of the time. This is all very unusual for Justice Weinberg. He has heard 80 cases since he joined the Court of Appeal in the last 10 years that where he was asked to decide whether a jury's verdict was unsafe or not. This is the first time that he hasn't been part of a unanimous bench. This is the first time anyone's disagreed with him or he's disagreed with anyone else about whether a verdict was safe or not.
So this is sort of a departure from a pattern.
For him it is, less so for President Maxwell. He's heard 85 cases and six of those involved the court splitting. Every one of those six, he thought the verdict was unsafe and either one or two other judges disagreed with him.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC RN or via podcast. My guests today are Professor Jeremy Gans, criminal law expert from the University of Melbourne, and Guardian journalist David Marr. We're talking about the Victorian Court of Appeal's decision, 2-1, upholding the conviction of Cardinal George Pell for multiple child sex offences. David Marr, returning to the minority judgment of Justice Weinberg, what did he have to say about the evidence of the complainant?
Weinberg is at pains to say you can be fooled by the demeanour of a complainant in the witness box, even the way in which such a complainant stands up to the kind of withering cross-examination for which Richter is famous. The man's demeanour, which so impressed Chris Maxwell and the Chief Justice of Victoria, is dismissed by Weinberg. Weinberg completely disbelieves the second incident. I mean, the first incident in the sacristy and the third incident, the second incident is of a groping of the complainant
in a corridor.
In a crowded passageway. Now, he just sort of sweeps them aside. It's very, very interesting to read with the detail of Weinberg's judgment. Here's one little example. The complainant had thought at first that the two incidents happened about a month apart before Christmas in 1996. Now, it turned out that when all the diaries were consulted and everybody's movements were clear, they were about 2 months apart, one before and one after Christmas. Nothing of substance turned on that. And yet Weinberg makes an immense point of saying that that mistake undercuts the reliability of the complainant's evidence. And you read that and you think, that's extraordinarily harsh. And the judgment of the man, of the complainant, is very, very harsh.
A lot of things you said there. Jeremy Gans.
I think that's a bit of an overstatement of his take, actually, because he actually said, at least in relation to the main incidents in the sacristy, that if the complainant's evidence had stood alone without the opportunity witnesses from the defence, he would have upheld the conviction. Despite his concerns about the complainant sometimes prevaricating or trying to shift his story, he said, to help out the prosecution. It was the combination of what he saw as problems in the complainant's evidence, which weren't enough on their own to make the verdict safe, with the opportunity witnesses that is why Justice Weinberg said he thought the verdict was unsafe. I don't think he was as harsh about the complainant as you're saying.
Jeremy, I think he's pretty harsh.
Well, but that's being said, he would have upheld the conviction but for those opportunity witnesses. But you are right that he was extremely harsh about that second allegation involving the groping in the corridor. And I must say, I look at that second allegation and don't find it anywhere near as incredible as he says. On the other hand, the majority said the thing about the second allegation is it's exactly the sort of thing you wouldn't say if you were making up accusations against someone. And again, I'm not sure about that either.
Well, it's interesting that Weinberg doesn't really address the question of what this man could have made up to make his story less troublesome for him. The majority do. The majority point to a couple of places where he's clearly, in their view, was not embellishing his story, because if he'd wanted to make it easier for himself, he could have embellished. But it's just not a topic that Weinberg really canvasses. And I think, again, that that is harsh, because there are of course, problems with the complainant's story, and they're problems which he could have cured for himself. Take this one, for instance. Weinberg was very sceptical of him because it has always been the evidence of the complainant that he and the other choir boy involved in the incident in the sacristy never afterwards discussed it with one another. It would have been perfectly easy for somebody who was willing to embellish their story to have claimed constant conversations between the two of them over the years because the other man is dead. But no such embellishment was offered to the court, and it speaks to the man's credit that the story did have problems, but yet the majority of the court found so emphatically that the story as a whole held true.
Now, Justice Weinberg also spoke about the Lindy Chamberlain case. What did he say, Jeremy Gans?
Well, that case, of course, is another occasion in a high-profile matter where a court divided very sharply. The High Court dismissed Lindy Chamberlain's appeal 3-2. Justice Weinberg was very inspired by one of the dissenting judges, Justice William Dean, who became Governor General. He didn't believe the claim by Lindy Chamberlain that Dingo had taken the baby, and he actually thought the prosecution case was more plausible than hers, and yet he still would have voted to free her from prison because there was too much doubt in his mind about the case. And Justice Weinberg was very inspired by what Justice Dean wrote, and in particular his emphatic view that you should never leave jurors alone to make their decision, that appeal judges should bear the burden of deciding for themselves so as not to burden the jury with any possible miscarriage of justice.
Now, invoking the memory of Lindy Chamberlain, perhaps Australia's most high-profile victim of a miscarriage of justice, that's a very powerful exercise, isn't it?
Well, it picks up the one occasion that's best known where a jury failed. I'm not too hard on that jury, mind you. I think that failure is shared by a lot of people, the police, the prosecutors, the appeal courts and the High Court. But it is what drove the High Court 10 years later to say that the role for a judge in an unsafe verdict case is to be something like a second jury, deciding for themselves whether they have doubt and allowing only for the jury's advantages in seeing the evidence themselves, which of course in this case were very slim advantages.
Because it was all on video.
Weinberg says a very slim advantage, but the majority said that it was a more considerable advantage than that. Mm. But then, of course, in the end, it doesn't turn on the question of advantage because the majority was so convinced of the evidence. They didn't have to deal with doubt because they were convinced. It was Weinberg who very elegantly talks about what you do with doubt under those circumstances.
Mm.
Majority didn't have any doubt.
How often a case is brought to the courts and the evidence essentially does boil down simply to the evidence of the complainant versus the denial of the accused? Does that happen very often these days? Presumably it does.
It does, but it depends on what you mean by no other evidence. The old rule used to be that it would be very difficult to bring a case without a corroborating witness, and that means someone who can confirm most of the details of what the complainant said. These days, though, most cases that still go to the courts have some other evidence, for example, that places the accused and the complainant in the same room, or has the complainant talking to people afterwards, or has some pattern of behaviour that's before the court that suggests that the accused does this sort of thing. Justice Weinberg makes the point that this case lacks all of that. It does just turn on the evidence of the complainant. However, the majority says there's one point which is separate from the complainant that backs up the prosecution case, and that was his knowledge of what the sacristy looked like. He told the police what it looked like, and they said the jury is entitled to take that as independent confirmation of his evidence.
And there was that other tiny little thing, which was the fact that Pell was using that room to get out of his robes, because his own room next door was still being renovated in some massive renovation of St. Patrick's Cathedral that had been going on that year. So the fact of the Archbishop appearing in the room was something that also goes to the credibility of his story. It's just sort of a stray little detail there that helped him.
That's right. Although Justice Weinberg relies, rightly or wrongly, on the defence argument that there was a tour of the cathedral and that the complainant could well have seen the sacristies at that point.
Yes.
How often are appeals against conviction successful because an appeal court finds that the jury verdict was unreasonable? Do we know the stats about this?
I've done the numbers in Victoria. I went back to 2016, and the rate is about 1 in 4 of these attempts succeed. In the case of Justice Weinberg, I went back through all of his judgments. He's heard 80, and he found an unsafe verdict in 1 in 5 of those cases. President Maxwell found an unsafe verdict in around 1 in 8 of his cases.
All three judges, very highly respected. Ferguson and Maxwell are the two senior judges in the state. But many make the point that Weinberg is considered a preeminent expert in criminal law trials. How important is that expertise, David Marr?
It's very important indeed. In some circles, Weinberg is considered a kind of god of the criminal law. But there are also those who say that in cases of historic sexual abuse, he's a pretty harsh marker. His conduct during the appeal was absolutely perfect. His questioning was lucid and always to the point. He's a very impressive man. But in the end, this was not so much an exercise in parsing the law. It was a jury exercise in assessing the strength of the evidence. Now, he brings immense experience to bear on that, but he came to a conclusion based on his reading of the facts, which was contrary to the reading of the majority of the court. He's not a man to be underestimated. He has a long and distinguished record in the criminal law. In my view, in this case, he was too harsh a marker.
It is reported that Pell's legal team will seek leave to appeal to the High Court of Australia. What percentage of leave to appeal applications are granted? In other words, how often does the High Court grant leave to appeal in these kinds of cases?
The court receives around 400 or 500 applications for special leave to appeal every year, and it ends up hearing these days around 50 cases a year, and that includes constitutional cases which are brought to it separately.
So what percentage are we talking about there? It's about 13%?
Very low.
Very low.
It's a bit invidious to look at the numbers completely because some of those cases are totally hopeless and are brought by unrepresented litigants. Some are people running interminable immigration appeals and they have to go to the High Court for procedural reasons. So coming up with a definite number is difficult. But what is clear is he has extremely long odds.
Long odds. You think it's long odds for the High Court to entertain this case?
Everyone in his position has long odds.
Jeremy, I'm wondering about this, though. Lately, over the last few years, the High Court has been determined to set down sort of some clear ground rules on the conduct of historical sex abuse cases in the courts. One of the areas they haven't sort of set down rules for is precisely what we're talking about in the Pell case, which is unsafe verdicts. There was a case recently, and it was another Weinberg case actually, called Tyrrell's case, but the High Court's knocked it back. Whether that means they don't feel some regulation from on high is needed in this particular area of the law, or whether they're waiting for a better case to set fresh ground rules down, I don't know. But it is an area of interest for them generally, that how we conduct in a way that we haven't really much in the past, very old cases and, of these horrible crimes.
And Jeremy, in response to what David's saying, remind us what the Tyrrell case is. It's the Court of Appeal overturned child sex offence convictions of an 80-year-old Christian brother, I believe. Again, it was the word of the complainant, a student who said he'd been abused for many, many years, starting when he was 10 years old. But there were discrepancies. The complainant talked about assaults taking place a couple of years after the accused had left school. He was looking back 50 years, not 20 years. And the complainant had a long and serious criminal history. And of course, many victims do go on to have difficult lives. But does, as David has written very eloquently on this case, that makes them more difficult to believe.
The Tyrrell case is a much harder one for the prosecution. There are the problems you described. The complainant has all sorts of difficulties. But he also, some of the things he said to the police, he later, when they didn't fit the evidence, said, they must have been nightmares I had. Now, that's a very difficult position for the prosecution. And the position of the prosecution in Pell's case is much, much stronger than that. So to the extent that they knocked back Tyrrell, I don't think that itself is a sign that they're going to knock back Pell. David, what you said is correct, that I think the court is overdue to have another go at the test for unsafe verdicts. The last time they definitively ruled on that was 25 years ago in another child sexual abuse case where they split 4-3 and upheld an appeal and held that the jury's verdict was unsafe. But the law has been unstable ever since. The four in the majority set down four sentences where they set down the test. But since then, other High Court judges have added sentences of their own. those additional sentences, and it all just sounds like words to most people.
Rhetorical shifts of most extraordinary nuances.
That's right, but they got picked up in this very case. The majority said they want to use the extra sentences from the High Court, which are all about whether the jury must have had a doubt or not. And Justice Weinberg has been saying, ever since Tyrrell's case, in fact, that that's not the test, that the test is what the High Court set down in 1994.
And Weinberg's view is whether a judge, him or herself, has a doubt about the guilt. Is that right?
That's right. And specifically whether the judge feels there's a significant possibility that an innocent person has been convicted. So they use different words at times in their judgment. But it's worth noting that the majority on two occasions said that they did not have doubt about Pell's guilt. The High Court does what it wants. If it wanted to take this case, it could on that basis, and there are some others as well. But equally, the High Court could say nothing's going to turn on this distinction in this case because the majority covered themselves. So they could say either of those things. In fact, they don't have to explain themselves at all. They could just say, we don't think this is an appropriate vehicle for us to guide the law.
Because even if the court were to say, all right, then all of the judges should have looked at the strength of the evidence in exactly the same way as Weinberg looked at the evidence, the result would still be the same. What we're talking about here is how a judge's doubts are to be measured against the verdict and on what grounds you can substitute your doubts as a judge for the certainties of, or the apparent certainties of, a jury. But none of that machinery comes into play until you have significant doubts. And the majority of the court didn't have them.
You're absolutely right, David. But the High Court is its own beast, and they can always say, yes, we know the majority said twice in their 125-page judgment they didn't have any doubts. But the rest of their judgment, they used the language of whether the jury must have had a doubt, was compelled to have a doubt, was entitled to not have a doubt. And that language, if they think it's inappropriate, and I'm not sure they will, they could say infected their judgment. I know that doesn't sound satisfactory, but the High Court often takes that role when it reviews cases. I'm not saying it will in this case, but I don't think it's the absolute barrier you're suggesting.
And we all take our lives in our hands trying to second-guess the High Court.
Yes, I'm making
sure it actually does what it does.
I got the prediction wrong in the Court of Appeal. I thought they were likely to acquit. I'm making no predictions about the High Court. All we can do is point to things that lower or increase the odds.
And we also need to say that by all the indices that we know, Pell is now a convicted felon. The notion that his situation is continues to be provisional is to look at the justice system and simply disbelieve its function.
I disagree with that, David.
Do you?
Everyone has a right to pursue their appeals, and until
Absolutely.
Their appeal has been finalised, yes, he's totally convicted. He's been convicted ever since the jury found him guilty, but with an asterisk, and the asterisk is subject to the long odds, and they are definitely long odds, of the High Court getting involved and clearing him.
Professor Jeremy Gans from Melbourne University and Guardian journalist David Marr, who's followed this case from the very beginning. Thank you both so much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's the Law Report. A big thank you to producer Anita Barrow and to sound engineer this week, Melissa May. Damien Carrick here. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.